Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it is time to enter the vault. Because it is Saturday, time to go into the archives for an old episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind. This time we wanted to revisit our original exploration of the Uncanny Valley. This was a two-part episode. Part one was originally published April 4th, 2017. I think back on this episode a good bit, actually. I guess I encounter a lot of strange, almost there simulations of the human likeness.
This one is one that that I think back to a lot as well, just because, yeah, you're always encountering some imperfect digital recreations of a human likeness. And then we have to sort out how we feel about it, but also how we've perhaps been conditioned to feel about it just by knowing about the idea of the Uncanny Valley. So, this is going to be the first of two episodes. This episode is Into the Uncanny Valley, originally published April 4th, 2017. And then in the subsequent episode, we are going to go beyond the Uncanny Valley.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And Robert, I want to take you back to a conversation we had, I think it was last December. It was right after I went to see the most recent Star Wars movie, Rogue One.
Oh, yes. And I am on the cusp, the very cusp of seeing it myself. I'm waiting for it to become a rental option. So.
Oh, it's not yet?
No. Still a week or two out.
But. So has everything been spoiled for you so far?
No, people have been a little cooler on this one. I think some things are probably spoiled for me, but not like that last one where everybody just really felt the need to, just lay it all out on social media.
Let me spoil one thing for you here. Mm-hmm. They go to space.
Ah, and there's a war there?
Yeah.
There are stars.
Among the stars. But there is one thing in the movie. Okay, so mild spoiler for Rogue One coming out. It's something that probably everybody already knows. It's also not really about the content of the movie, but just about which characters you see. Mm-hmm. But if you are ready, are you ready for this mild spoiler? Okay, we get to see, if you remember back to the original Star Wars, back to the 70s,
Peter Cushing as Grand Moff Tarkin, the guy who was in fact Darth Vader's boss on the Death Star.
He was great.
Remember him? Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's the enough of this. Vader, release him. And we love Peter Cushing because he was in all these old monster movies. He goes back to the Hammer movies.
Oh yeah, he was Dr. Frankenstein, like the villainous Dr. Frankenstein of the Hammer films.
And he, I think, was the hero of the version of The Mummy that has Christopher Lee as the Mummy. Mm. The one, I've got the poster for it in the house, except it's the Belgian poster, so it's Le Malédiction de Pharaon. But yeah, so Peter Cushing was the original Grand Moff Tarkin, this bad Empire guy who was Darth Vader's boss. And the thing they do in the new Rogue One is they bring him back. He's dead. He has passed away. Mm-hmm. This movie takes place a little bit before the original Star Wars is supposed to have taken place. But they bring this character back, and they have an actor stand in as him. But it's not just a recast role. They try to make it look as if this is Peter Cushing standing here delivering the lines with CGI.
And this is an odd choice because, all right, so you're going to have Darth Vader in there. That's easy to do. Darth Vader's a dude in a suit.
Yeah.
Voiced by James Earl Jones. James Earl Jones is still alive. So you can check that one off the list. But Grand Moff Tarkin, like you said, the actor is dead. So it seems to me like the first easiest thing to do is just don't have those scenes. If you know it's going to be problematic, don't even mess with it. Or just use an actual living actor, such as Wayne Pygram, who played him in Revenge of the Sith. Or go with Ben Cross, who's another actor that I've seen over the years brought up as potential Tarkin casting. Or, heck, go with Ralph Fiennes. Like, clearly you have the money to throw down the well of expensive CGI equipment. Just go ahead and hire Ralph Fiennes. I know he's pricey, but he's great. And Fiennes, he's the consummate evil Brit.
Yeah, he even kind of looks like a younger Peter Cushing.
Yeah.
He's got that same kind of angular face, like the thin, long face with the jaw and the scowl. Mm-hmm. It's all there.
And it's not like fans of various franchises are not clearly cool with recasting. It's not like we're going to be thrown into a traumatic spin, because you can look to Game of Thrones, James Bond, Twilight, Harry Potter, etc. Like, we get it. We can roll with a recast.
Now, I want to go in two completely different directions thinking about this CGI Grand Moff Tarkin. Mm-hmm. One is that I didn't like it in the movie. Okay. I saw it and I was just like, ugh, don't want this. It pulled me out of the movie. It made me stop being in the story and just thinking about, huh, how did they do that? I don't know. On one hand, it looked great. Mm-hmm. Like, when you see the movie, I think you will kind of have to agree it's, unless I'm missing something, it's the best CGI simulation of a real person that I've ever seen. Like, it looks amazing, but it still looks not quite good enough that I can just accept it and go with it. I kept continually thinking, like, ugh, what am I looking at? It's almost really him, but it's not quite really him, and it made me feel icky.
Ah, so in this, it made you descend into what we've come to know as a species, as the Uncanny Valley.
Right, so today is going to be the first of two episodes we want to do about the Uncanny Valley. And this first one, we want to descend into the Uncanny Valley, but not just talk about it in terms of the standard pop culture phenomenon, because this is one of those sci-tech concepts that is totally filtered down into the mainstream. Everybody talks about the Uncanny Valley. It's a totally normal, ground-level pop culture phenomenon now, especially with as much bad CGI as we encounter in the movies.
Right.
But it's also a scientific field of study. It's something that people are looking into with empirical research to try to figure out, does it really exist? If it does really exist, what causes it? What can be done about it? So we want to look at it from both of these angles today.
Right. So we should probably roll through some just fun examples of this. We're going to try not to go too long on this. If we do, we'll cut it and save it for trailer talk. Either way, we'll probably do a Facebook Live trailer talk on an upcoming Friday about some of these movies.
Okay. So I want to go back to a much earlier experience for me. Robert, did you see The Mummy Returns in 2001? Do you remember this one?
I don't think I saw The Mummy Returns. I saw The Mummy and I remember digging it at the time, but
not the old Hammer one or the Universal one.
No, the reboot of The Mummy.
What's his name? Brendan Fraser.
Yeah, and what, Arnold Vosloo, I believe?
Vosloo, yeah.
Yeah, I enjoyed him. As they kind of brought in some of these aspects of the tragic mummy figure, which I liked.
Yeah, okay. But in 2001, we got The Scorpion King. This is a character that appears in The Mummy Returns, and he's pretty much, if you want to picture it, if you haven't seen the movie, actually, you should look up video of this. We're going to tell you to go look up images and video quite a few times in these episodes because some visual aids will help. But if you want to picture it, picture the concept of a centaur, except replace the horse parts with scorpion parts and some other random arthropod bits. And the man part on top is Dwayne the Rock Johnson, except it's not Dwayne the Rock Johnson. There's a bit of a problem with the Rock. So the Scorpion King scuttles into action in the film, and you can tell immediately something is wrong because it's not just the Rock. It's this CGI upper body designed to look like the Rock. It's supposed to be him, but it doesn't look right. It looks like somebody took the Rock, skinned him, and then took the skin suit and then boiled it and then maybe ironed it and rubbed it down with wax and then stretched it over somebody else, like a bald Crispin Glover wearing a waxed up the Rock suit.
And that would be fine if that's what they were going for. But I guess the disconnect here is that clearly they wanted this to be like the Rock as a scorpion centaur.
Yes.
And not this creepy, inhuman abomination that you've described.
Right. And it sort of, I guess, works because it's okay if he's creepy because he's a monster. But he was creepy in a way that he clearly wasn't supposed to be. It wasn't just that, oh, he's a monster. He looks weird. Something looked wrong with him. And this was at a time when computer-generated animations were hot, right?
Yeah.
2001, they seemed to be getting better all the time. And yet they were terrible, producing these characters that were not only not convincingly human, they were literally physically unpleasant to look at. They were repulsive.
Yeah, it was a period when everyone was just foolishly optimistic about what we could achieve with CGI. And, you know, in a sense, maybe that hasn't gone away. We're still very, the Rogue One example, like clearly everyone was very optimistic about how great this looked. And even though, and to your point, it does look great, but within the context of the film, something doesn't quite work.
Yeah, I would say. Now, for some people, we can get into this more, I think, especially in the next episode. In the next one, we want to try to go beyond the valley,
right?
The uncanny valley. But I will say at this point, for some people, Tarkin was not over the line or under the line. I don't know where you'd put the line.
Right.
But for some people, it worked. And I do think that's an interesting thing to acknowledge, that while for me, I experienced this not to the same extent as the Scorpion King, but a kind of Scorpion King revulsion. Not everybody did.
Now, one thing about Tarkin is that the Tarkin CGI character is, correct me if I'm wrong because I have not seen it myself yet, but he is interacting with 100% human actors in his scenes.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or at least he's in a film with other human actors,
yeah,
even if he's not sharing the exact same scene with them. So you might think, well, if you just had a movie just full of brilliant looking Tarkins, maybe it would be okay. And maybe it would. But some of the classic examples of Uncanny Valley happen to be films that are filled with nothing but CGI characters.
Yeah. How about one from the same year as The Mummy Returns, 2001? If you go back to...
Oh, yes. Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within.
Ugh.
I remember kind of liking it.
I do, too.
It was a film that I think I kind of half watched, half worked on, like some just college coursework or something.
Uh-huh.
It was just on in the background, and maybe that was the right level of immersion in it. But I remember digging it. But at the same time, there are a lot of dead puppet eyes in this movie.
Oh, yeah. And it's – so I saw it at the time. I remember having mixed feelings about the animation. Like in some senses, I remember thinking, wow, that looks so cool. That, again, may have been a product of its time. We can talk about that more, how our expectations change as things go on. But also, I don't know, there were multiple things wrong with that movie, one of which being that the last line of spoken dialogue in the movie, as a friend of mine pointed out at the time, was, oh, it's warm.
Well, I could. I don't remember the line, so I can't speak to it, how well it landed, but I could see that being a problem.
Roll credits.
Now, another big one, this came out just 3 years later, is, of course, The Polar Express.
Now, when people talk about the Uncanny Valley these days, I'd say this is a top three mention.
Yeah, this is one of the defining nightmares of our time.
Now, based on a wonderful children's book about the magic of Christmas time.
Yeah, the book is wonderful, but it's certainly one of these examples of, you take a very brief children's book and you try and adapt it into a feature-length motion picture. That's very difficult to do. In fact, I'm really grasping for an example where anybody actually pulled it off. Like, the best adaptations of children's books that come to mind are all very short, very short films. Generally, I'm thinking of Dr. Seuss adaptations from the 70s and 80s, not the Polar Express, which is just an exercise in psychic trauma brought on by just seemingly intentionally weaponized, uncanny valley, the soulless puppet people.
I've never seen this movie, but I looked up clips to see what people were talking about. Mm-hmm. And, oh, man, they are not kidding. I don't know how children made it through this movie. It has these it has these creepy elves. It's got a creepy Tom Hanks as a train conductor. Mm-hmm. Nothing seems right. Everything seems like it's just about to – everybody's about to start melting and screaming.
Yeah, I think this is one where it was a poor idea, in my opinion, and the technology was not there to rescue the idea. Now, the next one we're going to discuss, though, I think was a great idea on paper. But it just didn't work out on the screen. And that's, of course, 2007's Beowulf.
Now, is this Robert Zemeckis who did this?
Yeah, Robert Zemeckis helmed it. And then the writing, it was Neil Gaiman and Roger Avery.
So wow.
some big names just attached to the ideas behind this movie. And, of course, based on the story of Grendel and Beowulf, which is a classic, you would think, hard to miss mm-hmm. action narrative.
I think that Beowulf could make a really great movie if somebody did it right.
Yeah, I think so too. I have yet to see that movie, but certainly has all the potential in the world. And they had a pretty cool vocal cast as well. I think Angelina Jolie is in it as the monster's mother.
Do they have Ray Winstone as Beowulf?
Yeah, he does the voice of Beowulf. And who was it that plays the monster? Crispin Glover.
Crispin Glover. Yeah. Now, bringing it all back home.
Yeah. Not one of my favorite monster depictions of Grendel, by the way, but he's a monster. We can get past that. But everybody else in the film really has the uncanny valley effect going on to a high degree.
I think I read a quote somewhere where a film critic was talking about how the monsters in the movie were only slightly less frightening than the humans.
Yeah. Yeah, the humans, it just didn't land. Now, at this point, you're probably thinking, well, how about video games?
Right.
Because certainly when you're thinking about computer animated human beings interacting with each other, staring right into the camera, you think of video games.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I think, here's the thing here. I have to say that I haven't noticed it as often these days.
I think a lot of game animators have found ways to get around the uncanny valley.
Yeah.
I don't want to get too ahead of our flow here, but I think one thing that I've noticed they sometimes do is that they don't actually go for photorealism. Mm-hmm. They go for a kind of more real than real combination of like a comic book style type character illustration mm-hmm. and then these other realistic aspects that when you look at a video game character, you would never mistake it for a photograph of a person, even one that's got really good graphics. Mm-hmm. But much like the way dialogue is written in films, you don't want to make dialogue sound like real people talk because that would be horrible to listen to.
Right.
But you do want to make it sound, quote, realistic.
Yeah.
You don't want to make your characters look too realistic in animation, but you do want to make them look, quote, realistic. In other words, they feel real.
Yeah. Now, this reminds me of a game franchise that I don't think I've ever played more than a demo of this, but the Gears of War series. So all the people in this kind of look like if you're going to be critical of it, you might say, well, everyone looks kind of like they're weird gorilla people. Like it was like we're in an alternate world where
unrealistically huge upper bodies.
Yeah. As if evolution took a slightly different turn into an intelligent primates. And yet, they look real. They don't look like I don't get an uncanny effect rolling off of them. You look at them, you can see pores, you can see hair follicles. They look real, but they are certainly not going for a 100% authentic human being there.
Hmm.
All right. Now I want to pull out one more example here before we move on. And it's a rare example of uncanny valley avoidance, a very specific type of uncanny valley avoidance. And that is from a fantastic stop motion short that was produced by the National Film Board of Canada. And you can find this online if you just do a search for it. It's Madame Tutley Putley. And it's a wonderful little film, got very, very French feel to it. Characters on a train, weirds, frightening things occurring. Definitely check it out. But the trick to it, these are stop motion animated characters and their eyes just feel so alive. They stare right into you and you don't question for a second that these are people. And the trick that they employed is that they used real human eyes, not in a, you know, depraved, evil puppet master kind of a way either. They videotaped the eyes of human actors and then blended the footage with that of the puppets.
Whoa, that sounds like an incredible gambit, because that sounds like that could have produced some of the worst Uncanny Valley feelings ever if it went wrong.
Yeah. And I don't know, there may be some people who watch this short and have the opposite effect and think that it's super creepy. I found it to be like this interesting example of circumventing the Uncanny Valley, but I'll leave it for you guys to decide. I'll include a link to this one as well as some of the other sources we're talking about on the landing page for this episode. It's stufftoblowyourmind.com.
All right, well, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will get into the origin of the scientific idea of the Uncanny Valley and its history and research.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
All right, we're back. So the Uncanny Valley, where does this even come from?
Right, so we've already been talking about it because most people have heard of this. They're somewhat familiar with it. I was talking to Rachel about it, though she was saying, you know, at least to her, it had this connotation of just generally synthetically generated images being creepy in one way or another. So maybe we should get into the specifics of the origin of the idea. So let's go back to the year 1970. Everything's great. Wait, is it? I don't know. But everybody's looking forward to the future in terms of creating humanoid robots. What are we going to be able to do? Well, the Japanese roboticist Masahiro Mori of the Tokyo Institute of Technology, he wrote a paper that was published in this Japanese journal Energy that coined the term Uncanny Valley to describe a problem that he was predicting with increasingly humanoid robots. And this was based on just some observations he'd had of different events, you might say, incidents in the progress of designing humanoid robots, such as consumer electronics shows in Japan and stuff like that. So what he predicted was that as you had a humanoid robot, a robot that looks like a human, and its likeness to a human increased, our attitude toward them would improve. Our affinity would go up as they became more human until they reached a certain tipping point of similarity to humans where suddenly our affinity, our friendly attitude almost immediately shifts and plunges down into strong revulsion. Being human is likable. Being sort of human is likable, but being almost human is horrible and repulsive. And then, of course, at the final end, you would have a real human. So you can think of the Uncanny Valley as a phase in a graph, an XY graph. And along the horizontal axis on the bottom, you've got the degree of similarity to a human. And then on the vertical axis, you've got the degree of our affinity for the object. And Morey hypothesized this graph would have these two peaks. You'd start with zero on both axes because a thing that has no human-like traits basically gets no human affinity response one way or another. We just don't, you know, how much do you really like an industrial conveyor belt? You're just sort of neutral on it. But as you increase the humanity, you give a robot arms or something that looks like a face, eyes, limbs. You climb this gentle, gradual slope to the first peak in affinity. He didn't name the peak, but I think we should name the peak. I think this first peak should be called something like the cuteness peak. That's not exactly right because it's not exactly cuteness, but it's recognizing something kind of human about what you're looking at.
Yeah, we don't have to describe cute to everyone here, but certainly this is Hello Kitty territory.
Yeah.
This is the domain of large-eyed, vaguely infant or kitten-like creatures.
Sure.
That would never be mistaken for human or real, but they resonate with us for a number of reasons. Like, we could do a whole podcast. In fact, we have an old podcast episode about the science of cute, why that connects with us.
Yeah. So they would include that. It would include all kinds of robots that are just kind of have general, very basic faces that don't try to have human skin or anything like that, that just might have like kind of a mouth and some cartoonish eyes or something like
C-3PO,
that.
Right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. There you go. That C-3PO boldly on the cuteness peak. But at a certain point after this first peak, this graph drops off steeply. So you keep going along the x-axis, but then the y-axis drops off not just down to zero, but far below zero into the negative affinity range. And this part of the graph is the uncanny valley. As the similarity to a real human continues to increase near 100%, in other words, as it becomes indistinguishable from a real human, our affinity sharply shoots back up the second peak toward reality. So I'd call this second peak the reality peak. It's when you become, for all intents and purposes, a real human being.
Yeah, I would also say that if robots were candy, the bottom of the uncanny valley would be banana flavored candy. That for me has always been a flavor where it's like clearly like not only
what are they, runts that have the bananas.
Yeah, I think so. Like grape candy doesn't really taste like grapes. But it's far enough from the uncanny valley of candy that you're okay with it.
Oh, you're right. Banana candy actually does taste like bananas in a way that makes it not really good.
Yeah. Like candy fans, I don't eat that much candy anymore. So maybe the technology has advanced, but my memory of the banana candy is that of an uncanny experience.
Now, one thing we should note is that, so this original paper was published in 1970. A 2012 English translation was published in the IEEE Robotics and Automation magazine, and that's what I was using as my reference, that English translation from 2012. So it has some graphs here. It has Morey's original graphs or interpretations of them. And we can get into a little more detail on the nuances of Morey's theory. But one thing I did read was that many years later, somebody contacted Morey and they were talking to him about this idea he had of the uncanny valley. Mm-hmm. And they were like, well, does anything lie beyond the peak of reality? And he said, oh, yeah, actually, there is such a thing. And he said, you know, beyond the real human, you'd have sort of like artistic ideals.
Oh, wow. Like the realm of forms even, right?
Yeah. So, well, I think he used an example of like a statue of Buddha, you know, a beautiful, perfect statue of Buddha. It's almost like we have greater affinity for it than we have for a realistic human.
Huh. Because we've been, to a large point, we've been conditioned to, right?
Yeah.
that kind of gets into this idea of conditioned familiarity that we not only have with religious icons, but also with pop culture icons.
Yeah.
So not only the Buddha, but also Robbie the Robot or even the Terminator or.
That does make me think that in some ways, if aesthetic ideals and things that we're familiar with through our culture might be even beyond humans. I mean, again, this is not like rigorous research. This is just what Morey says he thinks mm-hmm. or predicts. Could there be like a robot that we really love that's actually better than a normal human?
Well, you know, there's a study that came out last year, I believe, from Penn State University that was kind of interesting along these lines. So the researchers surveyed 379 adults ages 60 to 86. And they ask them for specific memories of robot films they'd seen and their general attitudes towards robots. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, with the age here, as you might imagine, they're really looking at potential care robots, like the idea of like, what kind of robot should help you use the bathroom? Do you want something that looks like kind of like a person, or do you want something that looks like a forklift with a forklift mated with an easy chair?
But if you look at the ages used here and 2016, when the study took mm-hmm. place, you can say that these people grew up with science fiction.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they might not have personally consumed a lot of it, but it's in the culture.
Right. Yeah, they definitely had access to it. And the researchers found that individuals who could recall more cinematic robot portrayals were increasingly likely to hold positive attitudes toward robots in general. So it didn't matter if they remembered murderous kill bots or well-meaning helper bots. The mere memory of multiple robotic portrayals correlated to pro-robot vibes.
Mm-hmm.
So the study findings, they also backed up the importance of human-looking, human-esque robots to invoke a sympathetic user response. But the researchers stressed that robot designers might want to incorporate robotic features that older adults will remember from their cinematic past.
So it's saying that, like, don't just try to make it like a human. Try to make it like the robots we have known and loved.
Yeah, like make it fun. You know,
yeah.
If I need a robot to help me go to the bathroom, make them the robots from Silent Running. You know, Huey, Dewey, and Louie, the little guys. Then at least I can engage my nostalgia a little bit.
Totally. So I want to look at a few more nuances from Morey's original paper in 1970. So one thing I do think is very interesting, and I want to come back to as we explore this topic more. Morey hypothesizes in the original paper that our perception of an uncanny valley might depend on the context in which we're viewing the being. Mm-hmm. And the example he gives here is he's talking about Bunraku puppets. And so he says, quote, "I don't think that on close inspection a Bunraku puppet appears similar to a human being, but when we enjoy a puppet show in the theater, we're seated at a certain distance from the stage. The puppet's absolute size is ignored. Its total appearance, including hand and eye movements, is close to that of a human being. So given our tendency as an audience to become absorbed in this form of art, we might feel a high level of affinity for the puppet." I think that's interesting. So it's not just the object, but it's also the context in which we experience the object. You might have very different feelings about a Bunraku puppet lying on the floor versus one that you go to see in the context of staging a play.
Yeah, I think the puppet argument is something to keep in mind throughout considerations of the Uncanny Valley, because there are a lot of people that have kind of an irrational aversion to puppets in mm-hmm. general. And certainly if you take just a still puppet and you hold it up, there are various puppets that one might find a little bit uncanny or creepy, et cetera. But in the process of performing with it, a talented performer is going to bring that to life. Like, that's the art form. And there's so many different varieties of puppetry. Certainly there are two broad categories are situations where the puppeteer is visible and situations where the puppeteer is not. You know, so you have your basic, the Muppet situation where you don't see the puppeteers, but there are plenty of art forms, puppetry performance styles in which the puppeteer is very visible, either completely or just their face. You see their eyes, you see that there's a person involved here, and there's not this mystery or this sense of deception.
Right. Yeah, I think conceptual clues like that are very important. Also is when you consider the idea of going to a puppet theater, mm-hmm. it also includes a certain attitude charging effect in the audience. Like an audience member goes to a puppet theater prepared to suspend their disbelief.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, you put yourself in an intentional state of open-mindedness about what you're viewing, and you give yourself an interpretive framework through which to, like, if you were not prepared to watch a puppet theater story and suddenly a puppet was just moving around, that might be a lot creepier.
Oh, right? Yeah, I agree.
So part of the uncanny valley effect is probably also in the viewer themselves, and in the, so the context is not just where you are, what's going on with what you're looking at, but what you're expecting to see. Now, one more thing that Maury points out is he thinks that there are going to be very different rules governing the uncanny valley for still objects versus moving objects. Mm. And essentially his hypothesis is that movement is going to amplify both the peaks and the valleys of the graph. So if you imagine the graph we said earlier, gentle slope up to the first peak, you know, kind of cute, whatever, has some human characteristics, then a dip down into too close to human but not there, and then a final rise up to actually human. He would say if it's moving, the peaks are going to be higher and the valleys are going to be lower.
Okay.
So a thing that is moving gets greater affinity if it's good, if it's at one of these two peaks, but it's even more revolting and unpleasant if it's at the valley.
So this makes me think of Samara in The Ring.
Yes.
Those scenes where Samara is emerging from the TV or the well.
Her movement is jerky and unreal. Yeah.
And I understand that they created that effect by having the actor or actress walk backwards and then reversing the footage. So you have this... You have this movement that is, you know, natural, but being reversed, it feels very unnatural, and it's hard to really pinpoint what's not working for you about it.
Right. So Maury, in the end, concludes, he gives this recommendation based on his hypothesis. He says, don't go for realism, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be so hard if you're designing a humanoid robot. Now, a lot of what we're talking about in these episodes is animation. He's talking primarily about humanoid robots, but typically these two fields get somewhat conflated in discussion of the uncanny valley, because in both cases, you're trying to create something that looks pleasingly human. Mm-hmm. He wrote, it's going to be so hard to get out of the valley up the second peak. That's the reality peak is so steep. Instead, roboticists should not try, and instead they should aim for the very tip of the first peak. Stick on the cuteness peak, because we know we can get there. Mm-hmm. Think WALL-E or other cute humanoid robots. The first peak is not really that hard to attain. People respond well to it, so why do you need to try to go past it? You know, as for animated humans, I think a good analogy might be, here's one, Pixar's The Incredibles versus Final Fantasy The Spirits Within, which we already mentioned. The former, they don't look like real humans at all, right? They're cute, cartoonish, non-realistic humans, but they're quite pleasant. The latter goes for and fails at photorealism and creates these characters that are stiff and unsettling. In other words, he says, don't try to climb out of the valley. Just don't go into the valley to begin with.
Yeah, this really brings to mind just the idea of, like, filmmakers and creators standing on the edge of this physical valley. And there's a local guide there saying, don't do it. Don't do it. The valley will consume you. And they're like, no,
we're Lucasfilm. We can do it.
Yeah, we got all this high-tech gear. There's no way that anything's going to take us down there. And then they go down there and it's just Jurassic Park or Congo with they just get torn apart.
You know, I do think the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park come out of the uncanny valley for dinosaurs.
They do, yeah.
And that introduces an interesting wrinkle in that, like, Maury is talking about humanoid qualities. Mm-hmm. It would probably be a related but different thing to just say animal reality versus specifically human reality.
Yeah. Because, I mean, for non-human creatures, certainly we've nailed that for ages. The stop motion creatures often, even if their movements are kind of herky jerky, they feel great. Stop motion robots in older films, I've never had a problem buying into them. And, you look into the eye of the T-Rex or the Velociraptor, and you never doubt for a second.
Yeah. But so one thing I think we should point out is that as prescient as Maury was of what would become this widely recognized pop culture phenomenon, his paper is not, it's not research really. It's just sort of observation and interesting speculation. Mm-hmm. So what we should shift now to do, I think, is talk about whether there's really any evidence that the Uncanny Valley, number one, exists at all. Is it really a thing? Number two, is it a unified phenomenon, or is it there's some separate things getting pulled into the net together here? And then finally, maybe we should look at, if it's real, what causes it?
Yeah.
Why do human brains tend to react this way? So maybe we should take a quick break, and then when we come back, we will get into more recent research.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com, Symbiotica.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Okay, so there's really no denying that there is some kind of creepy humanoid synthetic figure effect, right? We've all seen these CGI movies. We've all seen these creepy robots and had that feeling of, don't like it. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the Uncanny Valley, as described by Maury or as popularly conceived in culture, is in fact a correct description of what's happening there.
Right. Just because it feels truthy, just because it lines up with to a certain degree with how we feel about the world, doesn't mean that it is an actual effect that's taking place.
Right.
And or that it's even a fixed effect, et cetera. There are a lot of factors to contemplate here. Like, for my own part, I've always found it interesting, and I definitely think there's something to it. However, you line it up with similar cases in life, such as, say, individuals that you may encounter who have some degree of facial disfigurement, and it might be extremely mild. It might be nothing more than a lazy eye or some sort of cleft lip or cleft palate scenario. Mm-hmm. It just might be like their face is maybe not all that symmetrical.
Right.
And, you know, nobody whose face is perfectly symmetrical. But with all of these individuals, you interact with them, you get to know them maybe, and whatever kind of like initial reaction is present, be it just kind of a huh or a huh, mm-hmm. that goes away. And you can
– Unless you're a total jerk.
Unless you're a total jerk, or you're going to be able to relate to that person. You're going to be able to communicate with that person. And you're not going to be thrown for a curve every time they make eye contact with you.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So there is certainly – like in Maury's original formulation, he would, I think, put – different kinds of physical abnormality somewhere on the ascending slope, on the on the uncanny valley slope. So you have a normal, healthy human up at the peak, I guess somewhere below the artistic ideal of the great Buddha statue or something. But you'd have normal, healthy human. Then somewhere below them would be people who who look like there is something wrong with them in terms of having, you know, perfect health and symmetricality.
I mean, certainly, because just an ill person, you encounter someone who is clearly a little bit sick or a little bit hungover or whatever, you can tell, and it causes a light to go off in your head.
Yeah. And yet we can quite easily adapt to people. Like, you know, you see somebody like that, it is, you just know it is not proper to react to somebody with revulsion.
Oh, yeah. Like right now in Atlanta, as we're recording this, pollen is everywhere.
Uh-huh.
So there are several people in my life. I'm not really affected by the pollen so much, but it totally debilitates some of my coworkers, some of my friends.
And red face, puffy eyes.
Yeah. And sometimes they're like wonked out on allergy medication to boot. And you accept it. You realize, oh, well, my friend here is going to be kind of a pollen zombie for a couple of weeks. But that doesn't mean we can't hang out. It doesn't mean we can't work on this or that.
Yeah. So definitely the Uncanny Valley has plenty of critics and plenty, I think, of very fair criticisms leveled at it. I just want to go back to one popular article I came across, a 2010 article in Popular Mechanics by Eric Sofgi, where he sort of points out that at the time people were, as I think they are still now, treating the Uncanny Valley as a proven fact. But in fact, at the time, he says, you know, there's really almost no convincing evidence that such a thing even exists. And he speaks to an expert named Carl McDorman, director of the Android Science Center at Indiana University. And McDorman, who has conducted research on the Valley, offered his opinion in the article saying, quote, "It turns out that there may be more than one uncanny Valley. It's not the overall degree of human likeness that makes a robot or animated character uncanny. It's more a matter of mismatch. If you have an extremely realistic skin texture, but at the same time cartoonish eyes, or realistic eyes and an unrealistic skin texture, that's very uncanny." That's an idea about the perceptual mismatch that I do want to revisit later in this episode. But the article also speaks to a guy named David Hansen, who's a roboticist who specifically specializes in creating very realistic humanoid robots. I think he did that Einstein head thing.
Oh, yes.
That thing. So Hansen claims that even if people find overly realistic robots creepy at first, they get used to them within minutes. This is sort of what you were just talking about, I think. You know, you become acclimated even to something that you might at some kind of base level have a negative reaction to.
Yeah, I keep thinking of Alien Isolation in this because it's the game I'm currently playing, and I feel like the CGI characters are pretty well done in there. I haven't felt the tinge of Uncanny Valley washing over me.
Some of the voice acting's a little weak, but
But speaking of the voice, like the androids you encounter though with the Segson androids that keep
those are great.
Yeah, and when I first
Uncanny Valley.
Well, yeah, but when I first encountered them, yeah, they had the uncanny, intentionally kind of creepy appearance and the very creepy robot voice. But yet, when they were not actively attacking me, I was kind of cool with it. It wasn't until they started becoming violent that the mere sound of their voice or the appearance of one in the distance down a hallway would cause my nerves to react.
I mean, those things are funny. They're a good part of that game. But anyway, so in this article, the author also cites some other unnamed roboticists as well as his own experience when he's talking about meeting robots that he had previously seen on video. And one thing he says is, you know, an uncanny valley effect that was present when I saw a video of this robot went away when I saw it in person. I don't know if that's generally true of people. He claims it's true, but even if this is truly the case for robots, I'm not sure how it would apply to animations. Probably wouldn't apply to animations. But I think that there are some good threads to start tugging at here, because it's probably the case that there are more dimensions to the Uncanny Valley than Morey imagined in 1970, meaning more than just that x-axis of closeness to realistic human appearance versus distance from realistic human appearance.
Yeah, I mean, what makes a person human? What makes a likeness human? There's arguably a whole chorus of things going on there.
Yeah.
So it would make sense that chorus would play into the Uncanny Valley.
Yeah, so I do think that there are multiple other dimensions to be explored, but I also don't think that means we can conclude that there's nothing to the Uncanny Valley. And in the past decade, there's actually been an explosion of research on the Uncanny Valley. So I think we should look at a few interesting studies on the effect.
All right. Well, first one here that I came across was a 2009 Princeton University study, and they looked into the effects of the Uncanny Valley on macaque monkeys.
So non-human subjects.
Yeah, because that makes sense, right? If you want to see if this is an evolved response,
right,
let's look beyond the complications of human intelligence and human culture and look to something closely related to us.
Yeah, is it biological rather than, say, cultural?
Right. And so they showed a selection of the primates close to real quote-unquote computer visuals of macaques to see if they responded with coos and lip-smacking as they do with their fellow monkeys.
These
close-to-real computer visuals were essentially Lawnmower Man monkeys. Have you seen Lawnmower Man?
Okay. They kind of had that. Are you asking if I've seen Lawnmower Man? Robert, you know I've seen Lawnmower Man.
Yes. So, yeah, think Lawnmower Man, and you kind of have an idea, that level of computer animation. And the monkeys did not want any part of it. They averted their eyes. They acted frightened when confronted with Lawnmower Man monkey. So it's not much, I admit, but it's a little experimental evidence for the argument that Uncanny Valley is an evolutionary response.
Right. So if you can observe it in monkeys, there's probably some element of it that is biological in the brain. It's instinctual and not just something we've all learned to say about weirdly looking animated characters and robots.
Yeah.
And that would be maybe a weak piece of evidence, but still a piece of evidence you could put in the column of saying there is something there. The valley does to some extent exist.
Right. Now, the next study that I ran across, this comes back this is to one of the graphics that you pulled out of the, I believe, the original study, correct?
Yeah. The original, Morey's original graphs.
Mm-hmm. So in this graph, we talked about diving down into the valley and then steadily trying to claw yourself out on the other side.
Very steep ascent.
Yeah. So you hit bottom and that's where you have a zombie.
Right.
And as you begin to scale out of the Uncanny Valley, he has myoelectric hand and prosthetic hand down there as you climb back up, eventually hitting ordinary doll and puppets and ill person and maybe hitting healthy person at the very top again. But yeah, it's interesting that you have prosthetic hand down there, because this next study looks at prosthetic and robotic and human hands.
Yeah, this is in the original study. Morey talks about the variable creepiness of prosthetic hands.
And I found this interesting because I don't know about you, but growing up, I felt like crazy robot hands especially were everywhere.
Yeah.
Like every G.I. Joe show or He-Man type franchise, there's always somebody. It could be a villain, it could be a hero, but there were crazy robot hands galore. And I always found them cool, and I feel like a lot of us probably even fetishized them to a certain point. Like we didn't understand what it would necessarily be like to lose a hand,
right?
And the shortfall in the ability of technology at the time and even today to replace that missing limb. But we thought, well, that looks cool. A superpowered robot hand, sign me up, right? But back to the study. 2013 University of Manchester study, and they looked at prosthetic hands. They used 43 right-handed participants, 36 female and 7 male, and they were all looking at photos. And the photos were divided into three categories: human hands, robotic hands, like no question about it, that's a robot hand I'm looking at.
Yeah.
Like straight up Terminator exoskeleton or even less human.
Yeah.
And then prosthetic hands. The results, I have to say, reading through some of the writing about this in the original press release, the results were kind of confusing sounding. The subjects here preferred human hands and robot hands, but rated and certainly rated prosthetic hands as more uncanny. But prosthetics that looked more human were less eerie.
Okay, so something's clearly a robot, that's not too creepy. Something's clearly a human, that's not too creepy. If something is a robot trying to be human, that might be more creepy. But as it gets better at being human, it's less creepy.
I think so. I think that's my take home. And it also makes me wonder if the hand alone is an area, is like a subset of the uncanny valley. Because certainly if you're just working with a hand and trying to replicate the movements, the look, the feel of a human limb for an observer, we're not going to even get into the problems of creating something that the user can experience as a lifelike limb.
Sure.
But if you're just looking at it, you don't have to worry about its eye contact. You don't have to worry about micro expressions. It seems like it would be an easier peak to surmount.
Yeah, so if that is in fact the correct interpretation, that would seem to undercut the steepness in Mori's original graph, right, on the final peak.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering, because the hand taken in isolation is, I think, going to be easier to replicate.
Yeah. And Uncanny Valley, let's face it, when we talk about it, most of the time we're talking about faces.
Right. Now, speaking of faces, there's another study. This is a 2011 University of California, San Diego study. This was published in Social, Cognitive, and Affective Neuroscience. And they did exactly what you'd expect researchers to do when confronted with the uncanny valley. Grab the fMRI and see what our brains are doing when we're looking at all these images.
Oh, all these fMRI studies. All right. Well, what did they find?
All right. I'll roll through the basics of the study here. So 20 subjects. Not a huge study here.
Right.
Aged 20 to 36, and here were some of the caveats they had in selecting these individuals: no experience working with robots, no time spent in Japan, no friends or family from Japan, because they wanted to avoid any potential cultural exposure that would make them more accepting of androids.
Okay, so the idea is that maybe in Japan people just experience humanoid robots way too much already. They're acclimatized to them.
Yeah, that's the argument they made in laying out the study.
Like, okay,
let's not even go there. Let's just deal with people who have less exposure to robots.
Okay.
And they were shown 12 videos of a humanoid robot named Reply Q2.
Oh man, I'm looking it up right now. It's rough.
Well, they watched 12 videos of this robot doing various things. And they were shown videos of humans doing the same things. And in fact, the robot's movements and mannerisms were patterned directly after the humans. So you had a human version of the actions. You had an android version of the actions. A lifelike robot. And then you had a stripped down version of the android. So basically the android with all its skin ripped off. So it looks more like a robot, clearly a robot.
Yeah.
And it's doing the same motions as well. So this broke it all down to a human with biological appearance and movement, a robot with mechanical appearance and mechanical motion, and a human seeming agent with the exact same mechanical movements as the robot. Then in came the fMRI scans.
Okay.
So the main brain area of note here, the area that lit up where we saw the most activity, the parietal cortex on both sides of the brain, specifically in the areas that connect the part of the brain's visual cortex that process bodily movements with the section of the motor cortex thought to contain mirror neurons.
Okay, so those would be like the empathy parts of the brain where, we see something going on in some other creature like us and we empathize with it.
Exactly, yeah. So when viewing the human-looking android, the brain lit up at the recognition of a human form but registered essentially a computing error over the movement. Something didn't match up. So it's not, according to this study, it would seem that it's not the biological movement or the biological appearance. It's the congruence or lack of congruence between the two. You look alive, but you're dead. You look dead, but you move. You speak as if you're alive. So the researchers noted that this is something that could be retuned through exposure, but it could be at the heart of what's going on with the Uncanny Valley.
Interesting. Well, I think we should look at one more study potentially providing recent support for the existence of the Uncanny Valley. And then maybe after that, we should break and then come back next time to get into the causes, what would be causing this effect and the future. So I want to look at a study that came out in 2016 in the journal Cognition by Mather and Reichling called Navigating a Social World with Robot Partners, a Quantitative Cartography of the Uncanny Valley. Cute invocation of map making there, because it does kind of make sense. I like the idea of mapping the valley because that indicates that it may expand beyond just the one dimensional dip and is in fact more of a topographical space, you know, like we can extend into three dimensions. But anyway, so to get into the study, the authors note that while the Uncanny Valley has very strong intuitive support, people tend to take it as fact, experimental evidence for it has been limited and inconsistent. As we mentioned earlier, some studies seem to find evidence for the valley. Others don't. You know, they say, this isn't necessarily a thing. So there are multiple experiments here. First, they did a thing that I think was pretty smart if they were trying to chart a linear progression of the up and down peaks and valleys. They tried to generate an objectively determined gradient of more and less human-looking robots. So what a lot of these studies do is maybe along the macaques study ideas, they show you a lawnmower man, they show you a real person, they show you a robot, and they ask you to characterize, you know, how do you feel about these? What they did here is that they gathered a very large sample or relatively large sample of 80 images, quote, from the wild, meaning from the internet. So these wild type robot samples, and they had a bunch of inclusion and exclusion criteria. I don't want to get into all of them, but they tried to limit it to where it would kind of throw out all these variables that could complicate things. Like they tried to keep just certain types of pictures of faces of real robots that are built. And they had some exclusion criteria, like it couldn't be a well-known character or a famous person. It couldn't have objects overlapping the face. It couldn't be a toy. It had to be a real humanoid robot. And then they had subjects rate these images on what they called a mechano-humanoid scale, basically, to come up with an objectively derived score for each image by using this empirical research, by going to a bunch of people and saying, hey, how mechanical is this? How human is this? And then after they had a rating for each of these 80 images, and Robert, I've included an image, I think, down here to show you like what all these robots were. You can kind of see it starts with things that look not human at all, just like a lump of wires and junk. And then it proceeds up to something that looks like a picture of a guy.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. You start off with very kind of Wall-E-esque heads. Yeah. Then you move in through like skinless gremlins, and then through the sort of the expected hierarchy of humanoid robots.
Uh-huh. Okay, so they've got this thing, and then they rate all these images and sort them into an ascending scale of humanness. And then they took ratings in multiple different ways of likability and trustworthiness. Now, in likability, they claimed to find a robust Uncanny Valley effect where likability increased linearly with humanoid qualities up to a certain point. And then it took a negative dip as the humanoid qualities continued to increase past that point and then once again began to rise at the far end of the scale. Now, one thing I want to say just looking at their results is it does not appear that people were the most bothered by the things that were the most human looking. Like, given my understanding of the Uncanny Valley, I would have expected the stuff at the very top end of the scale to be the most disturbing.
Yeah.
But they actually kind of liked the stuff at the very top end of the scale. It was somewhere closer to the upper half middle of the scale that they really didn't like. So to whatever extent there is a real Uncanny Valley, it might not lie so close to the, quote, realism end of the spectrum as we think. They also performed some trust experiments by creating a scenario where subjects would be asked to trust these robots to invest money for them. And the results there were that basically they claimed that the trust experiments did show some Uncanny Valley effects, but the results were a little more complicated than on the straightforward superficial likability scale. The likability really did look like Uncanny Valley was being displayed. They also performed experiments with a more traditional, quote, controlled series of composed face images. So it would just be a series of basically the same face as a robot, then a little bit more human, a little bit more human, a little bit more human on this gradient of humanness. And they generally claimed to find that there was evidence for the uncanny valley effect in both likability and trust with both the wild caught robot image samples and with these composed face images that they came up with. But as always, more studies are needed. But that looks like there is one study showing pretty solid evidence that there is something like an uncanny valley effect.
Yeah, and I like the idea that that it's an uncanny valley, but maybe it's just a more nuanced from a topographical standpoint. You know, there are more little bumps and little valleys within the overall valley, little caves you can crawl into and lose yourself inside, and maybe even caves that turn into tunnels that emerge on the other side.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I mean, like they point out that there's a lot of variability in their data. Actually, like it wasn't if you look at their plot chart of where all the data points fall, and then they plot a line going through it. If you plot a line going through all their data, it does show the uncanny valley effect, but you know, there are outliers all over the place. Like there are some robots that are just consistently more liked more than the other ones.
I find it interesting that some of the higher rated ones, or at least I think what number 79 in particular, kind of looks like a generic human. As opposed to, say, go down to 74, that looks like a very specific human.
Yeah.
Like if I had to pick him or pick the human he's patterned after, assumingly, out of a police lineup, I feel like I'd be able to do it.
But also 74 looks angry. I'm sorry, folks, you can't see what we're talking about. But
yeah, he's frowning at you, kind of like, should I kill all humans or just shrug it off?
And
maybe today's the day.
That does introduce, there are a lot of complicating factors here, and the authors acknowledge this. Like these images don't all have necessarily the same emotional affect. Like some of them seem happy, some seem unhappy. There's enough variability across the board that you can think you're getting a reasonably decent answer when you plot reactions across all samples. But yeah, there's definitely a lot of different stuff going on here in addition to just being more or less human.
I like how 34 on our chart here seems to rely heavily on animated mustache and eyebrows.
Oh yeah. What is that? It looks like a very I can't add to what you've just said. It's got a white mustache and brow and beard, and it's saying, "Oh, bully."
Yeah. It looks like a lot of these incomplete puppets or stripped away puppets you see where they're like, all right, we got a lot of work to do on this thing, but at least we got the eyebrows and mustache in place.
But see, I find that one very likable. It doesn't look very human at all, but it's very, I want to play with it.
Yeah.
Okay, Robert, well, we've got a bunch more stuff to talk about, but I think we should call it there and come back and finish our discussion of the Uncanny Valley next time.
Yeah, we'll go beyond the Uncanny Valley.
Yeah, so we'll talk about what might cause the Uncanny Valley effect to whatever extent it does exist, and we can talk about, you know, what happens when you ascend that far slope.
All right. Well, hey, in the meantime, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is where you'll find all the podcast episodes. You'll find videos, blog posts, as well as links out to our various social media accounts. And the landing page for this episode should include some links to some of the resources we're talking about here today.
And if you want to get in touch with us, as always, with feedback on this episode or any other, or you just want to say hi, or you want to let us know an episode topic you'd like us to cover in the future, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
We'll be right back. Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.